Let's close the eyes, sitting up nice and tall, comfortable, relaxed. Let's recite Om three times. Take a deep inhalation. Invocation now, so it's right up on the screen. Read in or join in with me. Inhale. Yogena chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarotam pravaram muninam Patanjalim Pranjaliranatosmi. Patanjalim Pranjaliranatosmi. Okay, so Rashmi, you want to read the English translation?
Yes, I respectfully bow down with the folded hand and offer my salutation to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the munis, the sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on the Ayurveda of language, through his treatise on grammar, that's Patanjali Mahabhashya, and the impurities of the chitta, that's minefield, through his treatise on yoga, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali.
Wonderful. So, three most important things in life, you know, mind, body, and speech, you know, they always say that, right?
So he gets credit for
all three.
For writing down
Ayurveda
treatment
science. Yeah,
I imagine that would be very much in the culture, and or just I'm not saying this very well, but you know, sort of passed down from person to person.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
the one that compiled it all together.
Yes,
all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. What is that text called?
What
is that text called? Or is
there I believe what he did was, you know, there was an ancient text called Charak Samhita. Mm-hmm. And he, my understanding is, he wrote a very detailed commentary on that and expanded that. I don't remember the name of that text.
So, and his work on grammar would be in Sanskrit versus.
His work on Sanskrit grammar was again a commentary on the ancient Sanskrit grammar by Panini.
Okay.
So there was a very famous grammarian who actually started the whole grammar of Sanskrit.
Okay.
His name was Panini. It was very, just like Yoga Sutras, you need a commentary to understand the sutras.
So it's very cryptic?
Very cryptic. Panini was even more cryptic.
So Panini was before Patanjali.
Yes, Patanjali wrote the most exhaustive, most authoritative commentary on Panini's on Panini's grammar.
I know so little about all this, so during Patanjali's era, would they have used Sanskrit as their everyday language?
Yes. Well, see, the common understanding is that all the people who were educated.
Uh-huh.
and then most men folk, they would speak in Sanskrit. Somehow it was known that uneducated people, as well as women, they would normally speak in the common language.
Okay.
But there are some women known to have spoken also Sanskrit. You know.
Okay.
So it's... And this people, you know, gather this because when you read the ancient dramas and plays in your, written in Sanskrit, okay, so they will show that all the men folk, all the educated people, kings and their ministers and everybody, they would speak in Sanskrit. But their wives,
they did not
speak in Sanskrit. So this was it, you know. For example, if you read Kalidasa and all that, you know, that's how it shows there.
Okay.
Some did, yeah.
Part, so what about the wives? They just spoke regular language?
You know, like I said, there's some of these sages, like, you know, Maitreyi and all that, they all speak Sanskrit.
Okay, okay.
But some of the, you know, in some of the texts, if you read Kalidasa's text, for example, that's how I know that, you know.
Yeah.
Their men folk would speak Sanskrit, women folk, and servants and all, they would speak the Prakrit language.
Like regular local language?
It was called Prakrit at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a form of Sanskrit, not pure Sanskrit. But
it was very... Very different form of Sanskrit, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they spoke in that. In those
so places. Sanskrit, it sounds like, was never really like a common language.
No.
It's really more for the intellectuals.
Yes,
and
more for the
level,
educated
writings,
people, yes.
Educated.
And writing.
Okay.
Writing was all in Sanskrit.
All in Sanskrit.
Yes. Okay. Writing was all in Sanskrit.
So meaning like women and people who were like servants there,
yes.
Went to get education to whatever schools and colleges at that time, that's why.
Right. But now there is a revival going on in India. You know, there's a lot of people now, you know, they think that we should revert back to Sanskrit.
Yes.
So now you'll see so many people who are very fluent in Sanskrit speaking now. Very, very fluent now. So I was just actually listening to, you know, on YouTube, there was an interview by an Indian TV channel. It's a Sanskrit TV channel.
Mm-hmm.
So they were interviewing a Polish Sanskrit scholar from Poland.
Okay.
And he said that you know, his whole family grew up speaking Sanskrit.
Mm. In Poland?
In Poland.
Wow.
Polish.
Yeah.
And
what channel is this? Is it Sanskrit channel?
It's called Vartalap or something. Varta something, yeah. Varta Lab or something. It's a Sanskrit channel. They all have all programs.
Everything is in Sanskrit. On
that channel, yeah.
Okay, wow.
Okay. So all right. Oh, before we go, again, a quick round of introductions. Okay, so let's start with Karen.
I'm Karen. I come all the time. And learn something every time.
Mm-hmm. Where do you practice yoga, Karen?
Excuse me?
Do you practice yoga?
Yeah.
Where do you practice? With him?
Yeah.
Oh, he's in the regular
practice. Yeah.
She's been coming for almost 2 years now.
Mm-hmm. Well, 2 years.
Regular, very regular, yeah. And Eleanor has been coming for 8 years, maybe.
Oh,
okay.
It's just me.
I never started.
8 or 9 years, I think. She started way back.
I don't know, maybe 6 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So, Eleanor, I'm just helping to understand my yoga knowledge, expand it.
Rashmi, I go to his Wednesday class at the temple for the yoga. I'm practicing yoga for almost 15 years now.
Yeah.
She's very flexible.
And I'm Linda, and I guess I've been coming to your studio maybe a year and a half, I think. And I come here because I want to learn more about the roots of yoga. And, you know, kind of the, I guess maybe the psychology of yoga is so interesting to me.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm Sonal. I've been practicing yoga on and off for last almost 2 years with Subhashji only. And I'm loving these sessions. I guess this is my third or fourth session. And I want to enhance my knowledge about, as she said, the roots of yoga and the psychology of Surya yoga.
Good, good. So Yoga Sutra is a combination of philosophy, psychology, methodology, terminology,
lifestyle
of yoga. Exactly. It's an, you know, rather than thinking of it as a manual on philosophy, you think of it as a manual of human life, basically, because it talks to you directly. Right? Yeah. All right.
I was reading something and I came across, there were different type of yoga, you know, how the bhakti yoga and jnana yoga and all. So there was one part they talked about nada yoga, and I quite didn't get too much material on it. What is it associated with?
Nada yoga, nada means the sound. Mm-hmm. So it's the yoga of sound. So they...
how were you spelling that?
Nada.
N-A-D-A.
Nada.
Okay.
And if you want to make that sound longer, nada.
Okay.
So you either put a bar on top of the first A, or it would make double A, N-A-A-D-A.
Yeah, it's spelled two or three different ways.
No, the sound is nada, so you can spell it with an A on top, bar on top, or two A's. Nada. Nada means sound. So sound can be created by music also. So one part of nada yoga is to have music as a source of meditation. So all these kirtans and bhajans and, you know, overnight sessions people have musically to get into a very deep state of meditation. That's called nada yoga. Also these mantras, you know, when they are chanted in a certain way, they create a mind field which goes, you know, into deep states of meditation. Sound. So rather than meditating silently, you meditate using sound as your source of...
But not as a yoga, like when we do like yoga, like Ashtanga yoga?
No, nada yoga is for meditation.
Okay, just for meditation. Okay,
nada yoga is to use sound as a form of, source of meditation, right?
Thank you.
Yeah, how does that compare? Because I remember with Yogaville and yoga teacher training, they talked about japa.
Japa is a form of... it can be a form of nada yoga if it is done loudly.
Okay.
Okay, but most of the time when you say japa, it is a mental japa.
Inner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Internal. Okay. So when you do a mantra japa mentally, that's just like what Patanjali says in the Yoga Sutra, you know.
Exactly.
So it's the meditation on a sound, but mental sound. But when you do loud sound, that's called nada yoga then.
So like chanting a mantra repeatedly, that's nada yoga.
If you do it loud.
If it's loud. Okay.
If it is loud.
Audible sound should be there, a part of that.
Okay.
And then eventually they say, you know, the whole purpose is to sync up with the, eventually the universal sound, as they say, the sound, you know, the hum or om or whatever, you know. So you can tune in with that, and that becomes the final goal of nada yoga. Then there is nada brahma, and there is something called nada brahma.
Brahma, yeah.
Okay, so again, there is supposed to be four stages of sound, as they say, for nada, you know. There's para. Do you remember these? Para, pashyanti, madhyama, and vaikhari?
No, I don't know.
Anyway, so...
Is the depth of meditation?
Hmm?
Is that the depth of meditation?
It's the depth of sound.
The depth of sound.
So how does... Vaikhari is considered to be the sound that is produced through the throat vibration. That's what we are hearing. That's what I'm doing now.
Speaking. Okay.
But where is the original source of that sound? Para is the most deepest source, where there is no sound, no vibration, it's silence, but it's the source. That's the same thing as your pure consciousness. That's where the main source is. And then it starts evolving into a shape, which is called Pashyanti. Okay, that's the original thought which comes up in the mind. Then Madhyama is where you can now articulate that thought in your mind. And then vaikari is when it is actually produced through the vocal cord. So there are the four stages of sound, and that's, you know, it's again, nada brahma, nada, you know, lots of things. You know. I'm not even very very knowledgeable about nada yoga, but, you know, I've read a little bit about
that. There is not even one school. I think one school here in the whole U.S., they do the nada yoga.
Well, there are plenty. I'm sure there are people who talk about nada yoga. If you go to yoga, if you go to Sailorsburg, the Arshvidya Gurukulam.
Which one?
Arshvidya Gurukulam. That's where Swami Dayananda used to be.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Arshvidya. They offer at least once a year Nadi Yoga.
That's the only name I saw. Like,
Nadi Yoga, yeah. Okay. Okay. So. All right. So what we will do is to start talking about chapter 2. So just a quick recap, that's what I've done here, of chapter 1. That's what we just completed. We didn't do the entire chapter 1. We left out a few parts, which we'll come back to later. Okay, but the very first part, the very beginning of chapter 1, it starts with the definition of yoga. Remember that? What's the definition of yoga? Everyone remembers?
Chitta vritti nirodhaha.
Okay, so that's the definition of yoga, which is the ability to calm everything that's going on in the mind. That's good. And from there are, you know, these vrittis are the fluctuations that cause these perturbations in the mind. And there are five categories that were defined in chapter 1. Okay. So the five categories, you can read there, pramana, viparyaya, vikalpa. Oh, I didn't write the Sanskrit names. Okay, that's okay. So right knowledge, wrong knowledge, imaginary knowledge, memory and sleep. Those are the five types of disturbances that can go on in the mind. And then Patanjali talks about the abhyasa and vairagya. Abhyasa is continuous practice and vairagya is a sense of detachment. Okay. As the main things that you can do to calm the mind eventually. Okay? And then finally, you know, after talking about all that, I didn't mention it here, but there's a lot of discussion there are two main topics in the chapter one. One is Ishvara, which is God. Okay? There's a lot of discussion on Ishvara. And then in the final 10 or so sutras, there's a whole lot of discussion on the different stages of samadhi. Samadhi is the final state of the mind where you are into a deep state of absorption. And there are many different stages of samadhi that Patanjali has talked about. Okay? And we'll go through those later on. All right? That's the part that I have missed, which I will cover during meditation discussion. Okay? So, that's what we're going to do. Wrong place, looks like. So that was chapter 1. Okay. So this is where we start the chapter 2 now, all right? So that's the number 1 sutra in chapter 2. He starts with something called Kriya Yoga. Okay, so we'll, again, like we always do, we'll first go through the Sanskrit words one by one and then see the meaning of each word and then see what it might mean. All right? So the words are tapaha.
Tapaha.
Repeat after me. Tapaha.
Tapaha.
Swadhyaya.
Swadhyaya.
Ishvara pranidhanani.
Ishvara pranidhanani.
Ishvara.
Ishvara.
Pranidhanani.
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 Kriya Yoga.
Kriya Yoga.
So Kriya Yoga is defined as the collection of these three things, which is tapaha, swadhyaya, Ishvara Pranidhana. Now, some of you who have done the eight limbs of yoga, it will ring a bell, right? So this is a part of the eight limbs of yoga. Anybody remember that or no?
Yes.
Yamas and niyamas. Yes. So there are five niyamas, and these three are a part of those five niyamas. Okay? So there's a lot of discussion among the commentators as to why Patanjali chose to to repeat these and put them as separately here in the very first sutra of chapter 2. Okay? So let's just quickly go through these terms first. So what is tapaha?
Self-discipline
also, and self to the point that you're trying to put yourself into difficult situations. Okay.
Up to the point where you feel uncomfortable.
Up to the point where you don't feel uncomfortable. Don't feel miserable. But yeah, you try to do things which you normally are not comfortable with. Okay?
Yeah. I use some of the poses we were doing today.
Yes, that's
one. And
then do it until you feel comfortable. Okay.
Yeah, today we did a few poses that not everyone was comfortable with.
Oh, yes. Today I was like, oh, I don't know this. And then I was like, oh, I don't know even this. And I don't know even this.
Okay. Yeah. So what I would like to say is put yourself through some measured, tough situations. Okay. Mm-hmm. Measured in the sense that you don't go overboard, mm-hmm. but definitely do something which you're not normally familiar or comfortable with. So anything that you don't do on a normal, like fasting is one example I always give, right? Hello?
I think they are confused between those two bands.
Next door?
So this would be something you choose to do?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
For the purpose of becoming...
Strengthening the body, mind... Making everything tough, developing the ability to withstand the dualities of life, as they say. Mm. We are always, always confronted with dualities, good and bad, hot and cold, honor and dishonor. Everything is dual in life, right? And we are always going yo-yo, up and down, up and down. So how to maintain a level of stability, equanimity, when you are confronted with all kinds of duality. And tapaha is considered to be one of the practices which will help you develop that endurance, so to say. Okay? So people give examples of fasting is one very good example, tapaha. Getting up in the morning and coming at 6 in the a.m. in the morning, that's tapaha. Okay? That's totally out of your norm, right? And sitting in meditation for 60 minutes, that's tapa. Okay, so that's again one of the forms. And these days when people start talking about not just food fasting, but phone fasting, email fasting, WhatsApp fasting, all those things. So, they are a part of tapa. Okay, that's all a part of tapas, as they call it. All right. And there is a very common example mentioned in some of the ancient texts. It's called Chandrayana fasting. Chandra is moon. Okay, so moon goes through these phases, right? So full moon to dark night and dark night to full moon. So what they tell you to do is to have on the night which is dark, have no food. Okay, for that full 24 hours. And then start having, on the first day of the moon, first phase of the moon, have one spoon of grain of food. Then increase by one spoon each. So 2 spoons, 3 spoons, all the way up to 15 spoons on the 15th day, and then start reducing it. Same thing. Okay? So we eventually go back to no food for another 24 hours. That's called Chandrayan fasting. It's mentioned in many texts, in the old texts. And they recommend doing that once a year. That's tapas, all right? So, making yourself tough. And It's action. It's karma yoga, basically. You know, if you look at the terms used in yoga, karma yoga is tapas. Okay. What is swadhyaya?
Self-reading,
self-study. Swadhyaya means to study something. Swadhyaya. And it means self-study, basically. Adhyaya, right? Now, self-study can be either through understanding the ancient texts, because they are sources of true knowledge. Once you understand those texts, it will give you a deeper insight into your own self. So swadhyaya usually is given to understand that it is studying these scriptures and then looking deep inside you. That's self-study. Okay, so chanting a mantra, you know, things like that, they are a part of swadhyaya. Initially it's an intellectual activity, more thinking, more analyzing, etc., etc. So that's why they say you can equate that to jnana yoga.
Yeah.
So tapas was karma yoga, and swadhyaya becomes sort of jnana yoga, because you're really trying to learn, first of all, gain the knowledge, and then apply that same knowledge to yourself, to understand yourself. Okay? So that's in the form of jnana yoga. Then what is Ishvara Pranidhana?
Total devotion, total
surrender to Ishvara. Okay? Now, what's Ishvara?
God.
Okay. But God, as you have to understand that carefully, God, not as you imagine it or him to be, but God as defined by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras. Okay, and we'll go back to that.
So will we cover that?
We'll cover that in depth. Okay. What Patanjali talks about for Ishvara, for God, it's a very specific definition. Okay, and that's given in chapter 1. So we'll be coming back to that. So what I do normally is when we study the 8 limbs of yoga and we come to this part in the yamas and niyamas, then I spend 3 sessions or 2 sessions on understanding Ishvara. Okay, so that's Ishvara Pranidhana. Pranidhana is total self kind of surrender. Okay, Atma Samarpan in Sanskrit, another term. Okay, so you have to understand the concept of Ishvara. And very briefly then, in Patanjali's definition of Ishvara, what he says, it's a Purusha Visheshaha. That's the definition he gives. Purusha is?
The soul.
Yeah. Vishesha is a very special kind of. Vishesha means special. So it's a special kind of soul which never goes through any change. No change whatsoever. So what it's the Sanskrit terms he uses are klesha karma vipaka ashyayahi aparamrishtaha. Aparamrishtaha means completely untouched, completely unscathed. All right, by what? Klesha. And we'll talk about kleshas today. Klesha is all the afflictions, all the pains and sufferings and the stresses and strains that one goes through. That's klesha. But this special Purusha, this Ishvara, has absolutely no connection with these. Karma. Klesha karma. Karma means he does not accrue any karma, he doesn't have any karma phala, no results of karma, etc. Okay? Etc., etc. So basically what Patanjali says, Ishvara is absolutely the ultimate standard for everything. Okay? Totally untouched by anybody, anything. No karma, no klesha, no rebirth, no reincarnation, nothing. Always the same, always stable, eternal, non-changing. That's the kind of entity that you want to focus on and devote yourself entirely to that entity.
Okay? Now, does he say Ishvara is the source of?
He doesn't say that. He doesn't say that, but okay. Everyone else does.
Well, that's all
right. Okay. So if you go to Vedanta or other philosophical streams, they will say Ishvara is the source of this creation, right? Yeah. Patanjali doesn't have need for all. There's no need for all that for him, you know. Okay, because he's only interested in the Sankhya philosophy, which doesn't believe in Ishvara and all that.
Sankhya does not even address?
No.
Ishwara?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. Patanjali just brought it in. Okay. In Sankhya, they don't give you an explanation of how this creation happened, but they tell you what happened during the creation. And we talked about that. We talked about that several times, yeah. Right? So that's Ishvara Pranidhana, surrender, total devotional surrender. So that's becomes now the form of Bhakti Yoga.
That's the source of Bhakti Yoga.
So it's a source of Bhakti Yoga. Okay. So Patanjali has added the element of Bhakti Yoga into his Yoga Sutras, which is not there in the Sankhya philosophy. So what we are saying here is tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishvara Pranidhana are Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga in a sense. Those collection of these three. These are the three things mentioned in Gita all the time, you know. Bhagavad Gita.
So is Sankhya Yoga like what they call Nirgun Brahma?
No. Sankhya is the same as Patanjali's basis. Patanjali has based his description of yoga on the philosophy that's contained in the Sankhya Yoga. Basic tenets are the same. So it's in the Sankhya philosophy, it's a dualistic philosophy. Mm-hmm. Not Nirguna and all that. It's there's no Brahman mentioned there. It's Purusha and Prakriti. That's it. That's Sankhya.
Okay.
And then Patanjali has taken the same terms and same concepts and built his yoga philosophy based on that. So it's the same thing. Purusha and Prakriti.
Bulk of his philosophy is Sankhya, but then he brings in a little more. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. He builds his, not just his approach to yoga, but then he also gives you these methodologies, the 8 limbs of yoga and all that.
Yeah. Okay.
That's not in Sankhya. No.
Okay. So we talk about it so much, it's hard to know exactly the.
No. Just the basic tenets of Sankhya are the Purusha and Prakriti.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and then the 23 elements, right?
Okay.
So then he takes those basic concepts and builds his entire philosophy on that. So the third chapter, for example, is all about vibhuti, right? All these supernormal powers. Mm-hmm. None of that is in the Sankhya.
So is Sankhya a text that is a precursor to?
Yes, Patanjali's yoga. Okay. See, in the Indian scheme of thinking, there are 6 philosophical streams.
Okay.
And these are the 2 related to yoga, Sankhya and yoga. And 2 of the others which are very commonly mentioned are Mimamsa and Vedanta. Vedanta is one which is very commonly mentioned, and Mimamsa is the other one. And there are
elements of yoga mentioned in all of them. Right?
Sankhya, in all of these 6, you will see elements of Sankhya philosophy somewhere or the other.
Okay. Was Sankhya the first philosophy?
Sankhya was the most ancient.
Most ancient, okay.
Yeah, of all these 6.
So how would you translate Vedanta and the other one?
What's that?
How would you translate those?
No, there's, in the terms of English?
Yeah.
No, there's no translation.
There's no translation. Okay.
No. They're just the names, right?
All right.
So there are Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Mimamsa, Vedanta, Sankhya, and the Patanjali's Yoga. These are the 6 philosophical streams.
Okay.
And the goal of each is the same, which is self-realization. But the way of doing it is slightly different.
Uh-huh.
So like yoga and Sankhya, they are dualistic philosophies. They have 2 entities, Purusha and Prakriti. Vedanta, especially the Advaita Vedanta, only has 1 entity, reality. Major difference.
So these are philosophies versus religions.
Philosophies, yes, okay. yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no. When you say religion, I'm assuming religion means some dogmatic principles, guidelines that you have to follow. No, none of that here.
Okay.
No, there's no dogma attached to any of these.
You know, I guess I'm always trying to correlate it with my world, maybe.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
when you say religion, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by religion, I guess, would be sort of, the spiritual being as well as
sort of a set of dogma, I guess, even though that's kind of a harsh word, but yeah.
Yeah, but that's what happens in most.
Rules to live by.
Yeah, right. So same thing we have in Hindu religion also. There are dogmatic principles, you know, and then rituals and all that. But then you go past that, then you are into real, true philosophy, where there's no dogmatic guidelines, you know. Then it's just intellectual understanding, and then applying that intellectual understanding to go deeper beyond the intellect eventually.
So, like, I'm thinking of, like, Socrates. And so would he be one of the... So if you were to transfer him to Indian, that
he would be considered a philosopher, I would think.
Okay.
Not a religious.
Oh no, and I wouldn't think of him as a religious figure either.
Right. So it's a philosopher, basically.
Yeah. So are these types of Vedanta and all those are those names of men or are they?
No, they are names of philosophies, concepts.
Concepts. Okay.
Yeah, names of philosophies.
Okay.
The authors' names are different. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So, getting back on the sutra, you said that when he talks about yoga, he's encompassing three of the, he's encompassing karma, raja, and, agriti, is that how you say it? I'd written in my notes there was four.
What's that?
I'd written it, there's four types of yoga. So this particular situation, he's talking.
Karma yoga,
and this one's
jnana yoga. Jnana yoga and bhakti yoga.
I think she's confused about raja yoga.
Yeah.
Raja, I think he's not addressing raja.
No, this one is not talking about raja yoga here. Yeah.
All right.
Raja yoga is Patanjali's yoga.
All right.
So when we talk about the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about four different types of yoga. And these three plus raja yoga, which is Patanjali's yoga, which is the meditation based yoga. Okay, so that's the tapas. What do I have here? Tapas is the austerity of sturdy self-discipline, mental, moral, and physical. Swadhyaya is repetition of mantras or study of sacred literature, and Ishvara Pranidhana is complete surrender to God or Kriya Yoga. That's the form of action. So, in the first chapter, Patanjali says that you should do abhyasa and vairagya to attain your goal of yoga. Okay, so the commentators feel that Patanjali had three kinds of people in mind. Okay, three types of people. One is who are already deeply steeped in spirituality and they have attained a certain level of depth already. So for those people, chapter one applies. Okay, where it says swadhyaya. Abhyasa and vairagya is what you need, okay? And then
it's
you can attain.
To practice.
Then go and do that, okay? Then he goes to chapter 2, and then he talks about people who are kind of in the middle somewhere, all right? And he says that, and then we'll go to the next sutra, because what he says is that through the practice of this Kriya Yoga, you diminish all your perturbations of the mind, okay? And you also come very close to samadhi. Okay, this is what it says. Karma yoga, samadhi. So this they say is for the people who are at the intermediate level. Okay? And you apply this and then you can get very close to samadhi. And then for people who are at the beginning level, he says he eventually goes back to eight limbs of yoga. So that's for people like us, who are just starting at the base point.
trying to figure out
what's going on, right? So that's the eight limbs. So this is what the commentators feel. It's not. Patanjali says.
He really didn't say that.
No, he didn't say that. He just goes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So what do I have? Tapas. Let's read these, just because these are the notes that I've taken from my study of the different commentaries. So. What it's saying is tapas is related to will or the karma yoga, like I've said. And it is studied self-discipline, mental, moral, and physical to eradicate impurities caused by karma. Okay, action. Actions, all the karmas that we do, they cause impurities. They also, we are talking about kleshas and then vasanas. These are the terms that you don't understand, I guess, but the basic meaning is the karma is all the actions that we do, all the thoughts and behavior patterns that we have. Klesha is all the afflictions that we go through, all the suffering that we go through, stresses and strains, and we're going to cover that. That's a part of the chapter 2, kleshas. And vasanas are the hidden propensities, hidden desires that are subconscious levels. Okay?
They're related to personality?
Samskara. Yeah, personality is the result of these vasanas. Whatever the vasana, whatever the samskaras and vasanas you have, whatever the at the subconscious level your hidden desires you have, that's what brings out to you as your personality. Okay. So that's the tapas. What swadhyaya related to intellect? So jnana yoga, study of sacred literature, and repetition of mantras, and that will help you understand yourself eventually. So that's self study. Okay. And then Ishvara Pranidhana is surrender to Ishvara, related to emotions and Bhakti Yoga. Doing all action as offering to God and renouncing the fruits of action. Both the things. Okay? So whatever you're doing, you're not doing it for yourself, you're doing it for as an offering to God, basically. Okay. And you're acting on behalf of God as an instrument of God, in a sense. Both of them. So, I've mentioned this whole thing, okay? So, in chapter 1, Abhyasa and Vairagya were described for one who has good control over the mind due to predominance of Sattva Guna. Remember Sattva Guna, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas?
Yes.
So, that's what they say. These are the commentators' words. But then in chapter 2, Kriya Yoga is suggested for those whose minds are outwardly focused as they are dominated by Rajas and Tamas Guna. So again, you know, people like us who are more dominated by Rajas and Tamas, let's do what's given in the chapter 2, which is Kriya Yoga is the first part, and then 8 limbs of yoga will come later on. Okay? So that's what it's all about. So Kriya Yoga is for the intermediate people, and Abhyasa and Vairagya is for the highest level people, and 8 limbs of yoga,
beginner
level. Okay? All right, this is number, sutra number 2. So the words are samadhi, bhavanarthaha, klesha, tanukaranarthaha cha. Klesha, tanukarana, arthascha. Okay? So, what are the meanings of these words? Okay? Samadhi bhava. Samadhi is the state of the mind, which is the almost like, you know, when we talk about different stages of the mind, samadhi is the final state of the mind, which is total absorption in your object that you are focusing on, in your object of meditation. Total absorption. Okay, that's samadhi. Okay, so samadhi bhavana, okay, for the purpose of developing that attitude which is very close to samadhi. Okay, so bhavana can be attitude or just the state of mind. Okay, samadhi bhavana. All right. So that's the number one. So there are two things that's going to happen as you practice Kriya Yoga. First is that it will take you very close to the final goal of yoga, which is samadhi, samadhi bhavanartha, and klesha tanu karanartha. Okay? Klesha tanu. Tanu means diminish, narrow. Okay? Tanu means narrow or diminished something, you know, make it small. Okay? Karana means to do. Okay? So to make the kleshas diminished. Okay? That's the other thing it does, karma yoga, or this kriya yoga.
Yeah.
What is klesha?
Um,
Afflictions, suffering, yeah, stress, suffering, strain. And actually, all the next few sutras are all related to klesha. Okay, we're coming to that right after this. Okay, because he's going to first tell you what it does, and then he defines what kleshas are. That's his style, yeah. Okay. So, Kriya Yoga, he says, is a composite of these three activities, tapas, swadhyaya, ishvara, pranidhana. And the purpose, or what it does for you, is first of all, samadhi bhavana. Samadhi bhavana, that means it brings you very close to the state of samadhi, final mental absorption. And also, klesha tanu karanartha. Klesha tanu karanartha. Tanu means diminish something. Make it very small, narrow. Okay? So, in common, you know, Sanskrit language, tanu is, you know, some women have named tanu.
Yeah, so okay? Younger one. Younger.
Tanu means one who has a very narrow weight, so it's...
That's actual meaning.
That's the literal meaning.
Oh, yeah, the younger one name is Tanuja. Tanuja is, I guess, the youngest child.
That's different, yeah. Yes. Tanuja is different. That's the younger of the two kids. Okay. But tanu, it means narrow. When you give a name to a person, tanu, it means beautiful, basically. Mm-hmm. But it comes from the fact that it is narrow waist, mm-hmm. Something like that. So, you know, so like this young lady who was at the front this morning who showed that...
She was able to do,
yeah. Her name is Tanu.
Is it?
She lives up to her name, doesn't she? It's a tiny and narrow
movement, yeah. But strong.
Very strong.
Very strong. Really.
Yeah. Yeah, so her name is Tanu. Okay, so Tanu Karanartha means that we are doing it for the purpose of diminishing all the kleshas, making them almost non-existent.
Could you say to... relieve our suffering?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's what it is saying. Relieve our suffering. Okay.
So to help us endure.
Yes.
All the stuff of being human.
Yes. Okay. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. When we are able to endure, we are able to stay at a level of equanimity despite all the ups and downs that life makes us go.
To rise above.
Yes, rise above, yes. Rise above, yes. Yes. They help us minimize, you know, this is a translation by Swami Satchidananda, and I don't like that word he uses, so bear with me. I just used it blindly.
Which word didn't you?
Obstacles.
Obstacles.
Klesha is not obstacles.
It almost implies that there's something put in our way.
Yeah, no, that's klesha is not obstacle. Klesha is suffering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, klesha is not an obstacle. I don't like this word that he uses.
Yeah, klesha is not. I mean, word meaning or by word also, klesha and obstacle, they are different.
No, they're different. Okay. And again, it's not attained samadhi, it is samadhi bhavana. It's the... Bhavana is not attainment of samadhi. It is the attitude, or that means your mental state is close to that. Something like that. I'm just talking of the translation. So his translation is very his own personal interpretation of things. I should modify these based on my understanding. Okay. So this is just a pictorial view of how the mind is structured. Okay, I think we've talked about this before also. And, you know, we've talked about these four functions of the mind. We discussed this in the morning today also, the same thing that I'm depicting here. Four functions of the mind are the mind itself, which is the input from the five senses, and then all the output that is in the motor action, you know. Out action, organs of action, hands, feet, etc., etc., right? Five organs of action, does anybody remember? Hands.
Arms, legs.
Yep.
Mouth.
Tongue, I mean the tongue.
Tongue.
Yeah, That speech. Uh-huh. That's number three.
Sight. One. Eyes. No.
Okay. Action.
That's action. Okay.
Eyes is input.
Right.
How about ears?
Right.
No. That's input.
That's input. So we're over. Elimination.
Elimination.
Reproduction.
Reproduction.
Yes.
Okay. So five of them. Mm-hmm. Okay. So organs of locomotion, mm-hmm. movement, pushing, pulling, that's hands. Then speech, that is tongue. And then organs of recreation, procreation, and elimination. Five organs of action. And they're all controlled by the mind, basically. Okay, so that's mind, and then the intellect is the one which does the discriminatory function, picking among choices, as we said, okay? And then the memory is all the impression, desires, vasanas, samskaras, and all those things, the things that are deeply embedded in our deep subconscious levels of memory. And finally, the most destructive element is the ego, which is the cause of all suffering, basically. Okay? So what it says is that on the right side after the vertical line, dotted line, is the pure soul, which is the purusha or the observer, seer. Okay, so this right side is the soul, and on the left side is the prakriti part. Prakriti is the material aspect of our being. Okay, so what it's saying is that wisdom is disconnected from the kleshas, and awareness becomes subtle and refined. Okay, so when you do this kriya yoga, your buddhi will become very sharp. Okay, and when the buddhi is sharp and the ego is diminished, okay, then your kleshas will be diminished. Okay. So that's roughly what we are saying here. Kleshas will diminish, and then the separation between the self and the purusha and prakriti, we come to realize that eventually.
You begin to dissolve. You begin to dissolve, and you realize that you are the
purusha.
Soul, you are purusha.
Yes.
So this also depicts the duality.
Yes.
That we're talking about.
Yes, we always here. Yeah. Patanjali's yoga is all based on duality. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are always two entities, purusha and prakriti, and in his scheme of things, both are eternal, both are real. The only difference is that only Purusha has consciousness, and the Prakriti has no consciousness of its own, but it functions based on consciousness borrowed from Purusha. Yeah.
See, that describes it as reflection?
They call it the reflection. Mm-hmm. That's how they define it. Reflected consciousness is what is used for the functioning of the buddhi or the intellect. Yeah. Sure. That's Sankhya. That's pure Sankhya.
It takes time to grasp.
It takes not just time, but a lot of time.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, when I start thinking of these things, and I see what I understand, what I know at this point is still at a very intellectual level. I was mentioning it to somebody else. Have I assimilated it really into myself? I don't know. I'm not sure if I have. When I sit for meditation, I still have the same thought processes, same kind of disturbances. And if I am faced with a very difficult life situation, I get into problems. I lost my wife. I mentioned that to some people. I got into trouble. It just happens. So, have I assimilated all this knowledge? Probably not. But has it helped me? I think a lot.
Yes.
It has helped me a lot overall. But still, I would say, understanding is more at an intellectual level. Mm-hmm. Which is okay.
Right. You are where you are.
Yes. Okay. So now he starts defining what the kleshas are, okay? The five different categories of these sufferings, okay? So let's go through these. Avidya.
Avidya.
Asmita.
Asmita.
Raga.
Raga.
Dvesha.
Dvesha.
Abhinivesha.
Abhinivesha.
aklesha. Okay, so these are the five kleshas. One more time. Avidya.
Avidya.
Asmita.
Asmita.
Raga.
Raga.
Dvesha.
Dvesha.
Abhinivesha.
Abhinivesha.
Okay, so these are the five categories of kleshas or suffering. Okay. And then, of course, he goes into a definition of each one of these. All right. So let's see what I have in terms of my notes. So again, don't go by that obstacle translation. I don't like it. That's Swami Sachidananda. I need to change that. So what I've said here is the philosophy of kleshas is an analysis of underlying cause of all human suffering and the means to remove that suffering effectively. Okay? So let's go through this sutra now. That's number four. It starts describing what the individual kleshas are. So this one he's talking first about avidya. Okay? So what it says here is, read the Sanskrit. Avidya.
Avidya.
Kshetram.
Kshetram.
Uttaresham.
Uttaresham.
So again, avidya.
Avidya.
Kshetram.
Kshetram.
Uttaresham.
Uttaresham.
Then prasupta.
Prasupta.
Tanu.
Tanu.
Vichinna.
Vichinna.
Udaranam.
Udaranam.
Let me repeat that. Prasupta.
Prasupta.
Tanu.
Tanu.
Vichinna.
Vichinna.
Udaranam.
Udaranam.
That's the shloka here, the sutra here. What it says is, the word uttaresham means among those which follow. Okay, uttaresham means following. Something that follows is called uttara. Okay, all right. Uttara, uttaresham, that means what follows. So what did it say here? That avidya. Avidya is ignorance. Avidya is not knowing the reality. That's what avidya means. Okay? Avidya is ignorance. And kshetram is the field or the growing field, so to say. Okay? What do you call the growing ground? Okay? Kshetram means the field. Okay? In Hindi we call it khet. Khetram. Field. Right? So what it says is that avidya or the ignorance is the ground where all the other four are kind of getting their seeds from. They grow. They grow. That's so avidya is kind of the mother of everything else.
Okay.
That is the root cause of all the other four. Okay? That's how it is. Okay. Avidya is the root cause of all these four other kleshas. Okay?
That would be ignorance of Purusha?
Yes. Yes. Okay. It's coming.
Yes.
It's going to define what that is.
Right.
But that's exactly what it is. You're right. You're on the right track. Okay. So now what he's saying here is that these kleshas can be in one of these four stages, so to say. Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the four stages he's defining here? One is prasupta. Prasupta means completely dormant, completely sleep. That means they are at the very deepest level of your subconscious and they need a little more extra triggering to bring them up. But they are kind of hidden way deep down. Okay? So those are some of the kleshas which are way deep down. Okay? Prasupta.
So they would be ones you weren't even aware of, perhaps.
Yes. 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 Yeah. But when they come up, they come up
they
with
come
a roar.
Up, like this, yeah. And catch totally unawares. And
yes.
You don't know why you're doing what you're doing.
Okay. Now, tanu. Again, the same word, tanu. Mm-hmm. Tanu means, in this case, little, it's there, but not quite there. It's very narrow, very feeble, very insignificant. But it's there now. Okay. So, now it's coming slowly out of that subconscious level. Okay? Tanu. Okay? Then there is vichinna. Vichinna is something that appears and then disappears, appears and disappears. Vichinna. Okay? Chinna means broken. Vichinna means Broken and fixed, broken and fixed. And it appears, disappears, appears, disappears.
Is that what he's saying, intercepted?
Intercepted. These terms. Yeah. Swami Sachidananda, you know. I need to find a better translation. Can we say intercepted? I don't know. Vichinna literally...
Interrupted?
No, vichinna literally means that they appear and disappear. Sometimes they are very dominant. Sometimes they are going back into the subconscious.
Unstable. Doesn't he talk about ones that are there that maybe can come up, but you realize them and then you...
Something like that.
Depress them and hold them back, or you have some power over them.
So no, that we're not talking about that. Well, these are just stages of these kleshas. How to control them and all that—that's different.
Okay.
That's different. But what are you talking about? How they appear to us? So suddenly, you know, you have a feeling of love for somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then when you in a conversation, you have some love for somebody, and suddenly the person says something that really hurts you. Now suddenly it goes into hatred. Okay, so those are the kind of things, you know, where which you're fluctuating, you know, one way or the other, and then sometimes they will just go down deeper into the subconscious and come up again. Things like that. That's vichinna. Okay.
Unstable.
Yeah. Unstable. Right.
Unpredictable.
Unpredictable, unstable, but coming and going, sort of appearing, and sometimes they'll bother you, sometimes they don't bother you. Okay, so love, hatred, worries or some cause, some sort. Right now you worried about something. So next moment you might get rid of that. Things like that. That's vichinna.
You know, it's fascinating that he had a concept of the subconscious or unconscious.
Absolutely. That's you said psychology. He's a psychologist.
He is.
He's the greatest psychologist.
Freud was in Western culture developed
the first psychology of
the unconscious. And and that was like 1800s.
This is way before
his time, isn't he?
Yeah, he was amazing. You know, mm-hmm. Patanjali, that's why they say he was the greatest scientist, greatest philosopher, greatest psychologist.
Yeah. Really?
Amazing. Okay. So that's prasupta, tanu, vichinna, and udara. What is udara? Udara is absolutely on the surface. Okay? It's right there. It's really hitting you on the surface, right? Okay, so you have a feeling of love for somebody, it's hitting you hard. It's right there. Hatred for somebody, it's right there. Fear of something, it's right there. Okay, anger for somebody, it's right there. That's active right now, right on the surface.
It's in your awareness.
That's right now in your awareness. That's udara. Okay, so what it says that this avidya, this ignorance, is the breeding ground for all the remaining four kleshas, which can be in either one of these four situations. They can be either completely hidden in the subconscious levels at the deepest level, which is dormant, completely dormant, sleeping, prasupta. They could be slightly feeble, but, you know, not quite there yet, kind of lurking in the, you know, dark, you know, trying to get out. Then vichinna, which come out, and then they disappear, come out and disappear, vichinna. And finally, those which are strong right now in your mind. They are having the real impact in your mind right now. Any emotion, any feeling, any kind of pattern, thought pattern, all that's happening right now, that's udara. Okay? So that's what this sutra says. Okay? So avidya is the breeding ground for all that.
I think this sutra has stuck with me since the last time we talked about it. Because it seems like that is the root of almost everything, because if you could transcend your ignorance in all these situations, you'd be... it would...
You're home.
Yeah.
That's home run.
You'd have a different life.
Yeah. I mean,
everything would be different.
I mean, that's what we're all here trying to do, is transcend
our transcend ignorance. The ignorance.
Yeah.
Very true. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You got it.
But it's really hard with interactions with other people, because you don't
Yes.
I mean, really there's tricky. No way to completely erase ignorance, because you can never know the circumstances of what they're going through and what they're...
That's why it says, you know, multiple lifetimes. Not going to happen in one lifetime. Yeah. But you got it. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's see what my notes say. Let's read the notes. Again, these notes are based on, you know, what I read from the commentaries. So, dormant is avidya, being the breeding ground for all the others. It cannot be in the dormant state. Okay, that's obvious. Because it's the breeding ground. It always is on the surface. It's always there. Avidya has to be there. Okay. A dormant klesha can germinate when a suitable trigger is present. Feeble is practice of Kriya Yoga helps in thinning the active kleshas. Again, he's repeating the same thing, Tanu Karana. So, you know, those eventually, when we practice Kriya Yoga, these kleshas will be diminished to that level of Tanu. That means very feeble, very deep down the subconscious. Alright? Then, intercepted in this state, kleshas appear and disappear. When kleshas of attachment is present, aversion is absent at the time. It can reappear at another time, but not at the same time as attachment. So this is again with the same, you know, thing we talked about. It's there right now, and it may go away next time. Active and sustained in this state, kleshas actually exert influence on the mind at a given time. For example, at the time of anger, the dvesha, aversion, is active, and attachment is hidden. Okay, so these are the things that... to tell us that they are active. So only for advanced yogis, kleshas can be in the dormant form. Okay, that's what the interpretation by one of the commentators is. Okay, that otherwise they are always lurking in the surface somewhere, or somewhere down the surface. You know, they can come up any time. Any trigger can bring up those kleshas. Okay, that's... see what the other things are. Okay. So this is the initial, that first statement was what avidya has. Now this is the definition of avidya. Okay, this is what you were talking about. How he defines avidya. Okay. So let's read the words first. So the Sanskrit words are anitya. Ashuchi. Dukkha. Anatmasu.
Anatmasu.
Okay, let's read it one more time. So, anitya, ashuchi, dukkha, anatmasu.
Anatmasu.
Then the next one is nitya, shuchi, sukha, atmakhyatihi, avidya. So, that's the definition. Last word is avidya. That means this is the definition of avidya, ignorance. Avidya means ignorance, not knowing the reality, not knowing the true essence of anything. That's avidya. Okay? So what it says is, there are, he defines four things, right? Anitya, nitya means what? Nitya,
always there,
permanent, something that is eternal, that's nitya. Anitya is the opposite. When you add the prefix a, it's
no,
just the opposite, non-eternal, okay? So nitya is eternal, and anitya is non-eternal. Okay, what is shuchi? Shuchi means pure. Pure shuchi also is sometimes referred to white. You know, okay, white, pure, things like that. And ashuchi, impure, obviously. Okay, and what is sukha? Happiness, comfort level. Dukkha means opposite, pain. Suffering. Okay? Dukkha. And then Atma. What is Atma?
Pure self.
Pure self. And Anatma? Non-self. Okay? So what he's saying is that avidya constitutes understanding, pure misunderstanding basically. You understand as something which is non-eternal, you think that is eternal. Okay? Something that is completely impure, you think that's pure. Something that is painful, or you think that is very pleasurable. And then something which is non-self, you take that as the self. That's avidya. Okay? So basically not understanding the reality. That's all there is. Not understanding what the reality, ultimate reality is. It's okay?
It's perceiving prakriti as reality. Perceiving prakriti as reality.
That's right.
Rather than purusha.
Right. That's what it is saying. Ultimately, that's what it is. So then there are commentators who, you know, we love to give examples of these things. So let's see what the examples are. All right. So, non-self for self. That means instead of I have a headache, say my head hurts. Okay. So that will provide a paradigm shift. And treating ego as the self is the cause of suffering. That's exactly what you were saying. Okay, so treating ego as the self, that is prakriti as purusha. That's the root cause of suffering. Or kind of thinking purusha, kind of superimposing purusha on the ego, basically.
Yeah.
Right? Identifying purusha with the ego, in this sense. Okay, and that's what is the main, so this is meaning of this self, thinking of non-self as the self. Okay, anatma to be atma. Okay, then non-eternal, the material universe is impermanent, but we attach to it dearly, thinking otherwise.
Yeah.
We always do that,
always,
right?
Yeah.
This material universe, that's non-eternal. I mean, that's, you know, it's not going to last forever. It's changing all the time, constantly. And yet we are attached
to those,
to those things which are constantly changing. And we suffer in the process. Impure. And, you know, Vyasa gives the example of the body as impure, right? This human body, he says, look at the inside of the body. Anything that comes out of from the body,
it's
dirty, filthy, smelly, ugly, whatever you can think of, right?
Yeah.
Totally unpleasant. And yet, we give so much importance to this body. We think it's beautiful, you know, all paint, lipstick, and everything. Okay, so that's non-eternal, impure. And then painful for pleasurable, dukkha. You know, sukha for dukkha. So painful for pleasurable. Eating too much or undesirable food that is pleasant for now, can cause immense pain. We know that, right?
Yeah, all this medical science.
It happens all the time. So we are taking that, something which is totally painful, eventually, we treat that as, oh, pleasurable.
Yeah.
Oh, enjoy it now. We're only going to live one life, right? Okay. And then this is all related to ignorance. And one of the most common examples of ignorance given in our yoga literature or any ancient literature is rope versus snake. Everyone heard that term?
Yes.
Snake in a rope?
Yeah.
Everyone knows that, right? So that's the common example, snake in a rope, right? That's ignorance, pure ignorance.
Did they mention Vyasa,
to Vyasmuni? Well, nobody really knows. But Vyasa, you see, like I mentioned, these sutras were so cryptic, so brief, that they were. It was very hard to understand them without a commentary. Okay, so somebody had to really kind of know Patanjali's mind, and then give a commentary on these sutras. Because these sutras make no sense. If you read them just by themselves, they make no sense. They're so cryptic, so brief, so condensed. So what the historians say is that this guy Vyasa, which could be the same as Vyasa Muni, or it could be a title, you know, of a normal title. Any wise person could be called a Vyasa.
I think it's more of a title.
That's what many people believe.
No.
Okay. But this person Vyasa, his commentary now is considered to be the most authoritative, most authentic, and most ancient. And many historians believe that he was a compatriot. He was the same time frame as Patanjali, roughly. Mm. Some believe that he even knew Patanjali. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he knew his mind, basically. And his commentary is now the kind of the gold standard for every commentary. So every other commentator, modern commentator, they look to Vyasa's commentary first and then put their 2 cents into it. Okay. So that's what Vyasa comes up. All right. Okay, so that was sutra number 5, which is definition of avidya, ignorance. All right. So basically, you know, what Karen said was, you know, it's all not recognizing who we truly are. We truly are the pure consciousness, Purusha, but we identify ourselves with the buddhi or the ego, and we suffer, okay, with the prakriti. So, this is the definition of the next one now, asmita, or the ego, right? So, number 2, okay? So, what is the definition of here? Drik, the first one is drik.
Drik.
Darshana.
Shaktyoho.
Ekatmata. Iva.
Asmita.
So I'm just kind of breaking these words into different short words. So drik, let's repeat it, drik. Darshana. Shaktyoho. Ekatmata. Iva. Asmita. So again, the last word is always what's being defined, almost in most of the cases. So it's defining asmita. Asmita is ego.
Okay. So the subject is the end of the sentence, isn't it?
Generally, you know, in many cases, yeah. Yeah. Of course, this is one of the very strong characteristics of the Sanskrit language, that it's uncommon to any other language, most other languages. In Sanskrit, you can position the words anywhere in the sentence.
Order does not matter.
It doesn't matter what the order is.
Right.
You will understand it exactly. The same way. If asmita was placed right in the beginning, it would still have the same meaning. Or right in the middle, it would have the same meaning.
Interesting.
So that's one of the beauties of Sanskrit. It's how the grammar is structured, that in most cases, there are some words which have to be positioned properly, but in most cases, it doesn't matter. I am going would be the same as going I am, or am I, you know, etc., etc. Yeah. Same thing. No difference. Okay, so now this is kind of getting into the very definition of Sankhya philosophy. Again, we've been talking about Purusha and Prakriti. This is all Sankhya. So what it's saying is that asmita or ego, basically what it's saying is that ego is identifying the Purusha with the Prakriti. That's what it is saying. Okay? So what it's saying is the identification, as it were, of the power of the seer with that of the power of the prakriti. Okay?
So thinking of yourself as God? Is that
what? No. Thinking of yourself as the ego.
Oh, okay.
You are God.
Right.
You are Purusha, not God. Purusha. Purusha is pure consciousness.
Oh, okay. I got that mixed up. I was thinking Purusha was God.
No, Purusha, well, in the Patanjali's terminology, Purusha is pure consciousness.
Okay.
But because he gives the definition of Ishvara, then most people would like to say Ishvara is God, which is not the same as...
So Ishvara is separate from Purusha?
Yes, because it's a special Purusha.
Special Purusha.
So there are 3 entities in Patanjali's philosophy. There's Ishvara, there's Purusha, and there's Prakriti. 3 entities.
So is this saying ego is prakriti?
Yes, ego, mind, intellect, everything is prakriti. Everything.
And different, which is different from Purusha.
That's what it is. Purusha is atma. Mm-hmm. Everything else is anatma.
Anatma. Yeah.
Non-self. And that includes everything, this whole material being, plus our human body, which is a composite of mind, body, intellect, and all the other 23 elements.
So in Sankhya philosophy, Purush is Atma, which is there in each person?
Yes.
Or the, like, the divine soul?
No, the individual person.
Individual.
Patanjali doesn't talk of the divine, except Ishvara.
So it is the soul which is inside us, and yes. Then other than that is all Prakriti.
Yes. And every soul is individual soul, independent of anything else. It's a very different concept in Patanjali, in the Sankhya philosophy. Very different from Vedanta, for example. Very different. All right, let's see what the commentary says. So, it's the difference between capital I and small I. The difference is just the dot. A little blemish, a little ignorance removes the dot, and then we are the original capital I. Capital I is Purusha, little I is the ego. Okay, so capital I is who I really am, my true essence, my true being. But then you put a little dot, a little blemish, and you identify yourself with the ego. That's what we call asmita. And the power of seeing, hearing, etc. comes because of the power of Purusha. Like we said, remember, the Purusha is the only entity which is conscious, which has consciousness. The buddhi, the ego, everything has no consciousness of its own. Okay? It's all borrowed or it's all reflected consciousness. So even the ability to see something, to hear something, to speak something, you need that power of consciousness.
Right.
But that's coming from the Purusha. But to start thinking that ego or this buddhi is doing everything else, is everything for me, and that we're not even aware of Purusha, that's what asmita is all about. Asmita is the ego. Ego shines through, and we are totally ignorant of the Purusha. All right. So, this is kind of the summary of these notes, of this understanding. Purusha is the seer. Buddhi or Chitta is only the instrument for cognition. Okay, all the five senses, etc. Purusha is pure consciousness. Chitta is non-conscious. And I've kind of taken the word Chitta to mean the same Prakriti, basically. Okay, Chitta is the mind field, but Prakriti. Purusha is actionless. There is no action being performed by the Purusha. Chitta is the one that performs the action. Okay? Purusha is attributeless. There is no attributes that you can associate with Purusha. Chitta has all the attributes based on the three gunas. Okay, three gunas being sattva, rajas, and tamas. And all the actions that we do are based on what guna is dominant at a given time. That's what's going to give us our action. Purusha is just an observer, as they say, or the master, So Purusha has no attributes like these gunas. He's beyond the three gunas. Okay. Then Purusha is changeless. Chitta goes through change all the time, constant change. Purusha is, in that sense, eternal, no change. Okay. Then Purusha is the Lord. Chitta is the server. That's another thing mentioned there in the sutras. Okay? And then the two are entirely different. Therefore, if you identify one with the other, that's a mistake. And we do that all the time. Even though, this analysis says that they are truly different, but we always identify one with the other. Yeah. That's the asmita part. That's the part that makes us kind of one with the ego. So we are driven by the ego, and not by the pure intuition or pure knowledge. Okay. So that's asmita.
guess this is kind of obvious, but, you know, he's saying, too, that if you become less attached, you'll become more in touch with Purusha, right?
Yes, yes. It's coming here. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Okay.
Raga and Dvesha.
Attachment. Oh, mm-hmm. Here we are.
Yeah. See? Yeah. You just... You just put the lead. Right there. Okay. So there are two simple definitions of raga and dvesha. So the first one is raga. So the words are sukha,
sukha.
Anushayi,
anushayi.
Raga.
Raga.
Actually, it's anushayi. Sorry, I said it wrong.
Sukha.
Anushayi,
anushayi.
Raga.
Raga.
Let's read the other one also. Dukha,
dukha.
Anushayi,
anushayi.
Dvesha.
Dvesha.
So raga and dvesha are the complementary opposites. Okay. Mm-hmm. So raga is attachment or likes, strong likes for something, and dvesha is, you know, dislike, hatred, mm-hmm. Things like that. Okay. So raga is attachment, and dvesha is, you know, total, you know, I call it hatred then.
Yes.
Hatred,
you
know, dislike.
Dislike.
Very strong dislike, that's the vesha. Mm-hmm. And raga is strong like for something, okay? Total attachment to something. So, everything is based on experience, right? Whatever we experience in life, because remember, ego puts a label on everything, so whatever experience we have, ego will tell you whether it's I like it, I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
I love it, I hate it. I dislike it.
Yeah.
Okay? I want it again, I don't want it again. Mm-hmm. Okay? I'm feeling cold, I'm feeling hot, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's honorable, it's dishonorable. All these things are put by the ego. Okay? And this is what an experience does for us. Every experience, we put a label, mm-hmm. and then we relive that experience. We get either attached to that, or we get away. We want to stay away from it. Okay, so raga and dvesha are strong attachments and strong dislikes for things. Okay? Any pleasant experience makes us attached to that entity. Any unpleasant experience gives us a sense of dvesha or dislike for that. Okay, it all depends on that. So, you know, everything builds on that now. Every time we have experience every day, every moment in life we have an experience. And all these experiences keep building one on the other. You know, first time you have a cup of coffee, right, you like it. Right? You develop a certain liking for it.
Yeah.
That's what the label says. Ego puts a label, I like it. Yeah. Right? Then you want it more. Next time you have it, it's really nice. Yeah. Then you want it more. Now, every morning, 7 o'clock, you have to have a cup of coffee. If you don't, you get a headache.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what builds up habits now. All right? Raga. And same thing with dvesha. You know? You have something, you know, you don't like it. You develop a dislike for it. Kids, you know, especially do that all the time, right?
Yeah.
Mother gives a type of food to the child. I don't want to eat it.
No.
But you have never tried it. I don't want to eat it. Why? I don't like it. Why? I don't like the shape of it. Right? Why? Because he ate something which looked similar and he didn't like it.
Yes.
Okay? And that's what we do all the time. And I'm giving an example of a child, but as adults, we do the same thing. Okay? So this is based on our experiences in the past, and ego does all that. Okay? It says, you know, you look at him, you meet a person for the first time, ego looks for a little match in the memory, and this guy's face looks like somebody we hated in the past.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like a
totally new person,
yeah.
But looks somewhat like,
yeah.
Now what are we going to do? I'm going to stay away from this guy. He looks like that person, you know, he must be same or similar. That's what ego does.
It does, all the time.
All the time. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And that deprives us of beautiful new experiences in life. Or, you know, we just miss out on life.
Mm-hmm.
because we are not able to see things in the true light, the things as they are.
Which is in the present moment.
In the present moment, now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we are deprived of beautiful experiences, of learning new things, of understanding new things. We are deprived of that. We just don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. Ego. That's what causes all the klesha and suffering.
Yep.
Okay?
And all that could be dormant, and we don't even know why we're reacting like that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Could be deep down in the subconscious and suddenly surfaces up. Yep. Okay. And so the notes are, both raga and dvesha depend upon memory of past experiences. Pleasurable experiences cause attachment, and painful cause aversion. Ego is the root cause of raga and dvesha, as it adds labels to each experience. The example given is musk deer, which has fragrance on its forehead, keeps running around in search of it. that's one of the examples, you know.
Yeah.
They give. What's a musk deer? I don't know.
It's in Hindi, it's called a kasturi mung.
I know.
I think in Himalayas they say, but I never seen it.
Something like that.
Yeah, I've never seen it, only heard in Himalayas.
Yeah, I know. Okay, that's what the example they give.
Yeah, example is always given in like the religious texts.
Right, all the texts they give the same example. Musk deer. Okay. Unfulfilled desires, you know, when we have unfulfilled desires, they cause anger, which can lead to the total destruction. And I have quoted this Bhagavad Gita, very commonly quoted shloka in the Gita. Okay, so this is, some people like to call it the ladder of destruction. Okay, so the two shlokas from the Gita, they are noted here. While contemplating on the objects of the senses, one develops attachment to them, and this attachment leads to desire, and from desire arises anger. Why? Because unfulfilled desires cause anger. So if we have a desire and it's not fulfilled, it creates anger. And then it says anger leads to clouding of judgment, which results in bewilderment of memory. When the memory is lost, the intellect gets destroyed. When the intellect is destroyed, you are in a state of pure ruin.
What do you mean by bewilderment of memory?
That's confused memory, okay, and or just blockage of memory. Again, these are translations by some author, and they use words which sometimes you don't.
Actually, confused memory is a close
confused word. Memory. Okay. Messed up memory, basically. When you're angry, you're not able to think clearly, and right. So that's the Bhagavad Gita, very commonly referenced shlokas. Okay. What's abhinivesha? So this is something, again, it's a little bit hard to understand, but what it says is, let's read the sutra first. So the swarasavahi
vidushopi
tatharudha
abhinaveshah.
Okay, one more time.
Swarasavahi
vidushopi
tatharudha
abhinaveshah.
Abhinaveshah.
Again, the word that's being defined is at the very end, abhinivesha. Okay? So that's being defined here. Okay? So what it says is, swarasavahi. Okay, that's what it means is, swa means the self. Okay? Rasa means the essence. So it's flowing with its own essence, basically. You know, that's the literal meaning of the first word. Something that flows with its own essence, with its own flavor, so to say. Swarasavahi. That means it is happening automatically, basically. It is happening on its own. Okay? Swarasavahi. Vidushopi. Okay? Vidusha means one who is a very wise, very learned person. Vidusha. Okay? Vidushi is the Sanskrit word for the female. Vidushaha is the male person who is very wise, very learned, very intelligent. You know, he knows everything, you know, all that stuff. Like an enlightened being, Vidusha. Okay? So, the Tatha Rudaha, okay? Established. Rudaha means established. Tatha means thus established. Tatha means thus. Rudaha means established. So, or embedded somewhere. So, what this means is that an Abhinivesha, that the word means fear of death or the desire to cling to life. Okay, so literally, you know, in Sanskrit, you know, it comes from the root word vish, which means to enter. Okay, nivish means to enter strongly somewhere. And when you say abhinivish, it kind of changes the meaning. Okay, what it means is that you want to maintain status quo, basically. You don't like change.
Like a stable state of...
You like what you, where you are now. Status quo. Like they say, maintain status quo, right? That's abhinivesha, literal meaning. But most commentators have translated that as clinging to life. That's status quo right now, right? My status is I'm alive. And I want to maintain that status. So I want to stay alive. That means I don't want to die.
So fear of change is what he's talking about, really.
Exactly. Fear of change. Okay? Fear of change. And what it says is that this fear of change, this fear of death is so strong that even in a very wise, even in a very learned man, it's still flowing naturally. It's there all the time. It's a natural thing. That's what the sutra means. That fear of death is very, very strongly established in everybody. Okay? And this, you know, if you have experienced people who are advanced in age, they will show this, you know, fear of death. Oh, do something, you know, save me. At younger age, you don't even think of death. Really. It's not that all that strong. It's no such thing. But as soon as you, you know, start getting closer, you know. Okay. So even a newly born infant, a worm or a bird, is afraid of death. You know, you look at a bird or an animal, you show a stick, they run away. They know that there is...
Instinct.
And what they claim is that instinct comes from previous births. You know, you've had experience of death in the previous life, and that stays with you. Fear of, you know, being hit or being struck or being, you know, close to death or something. That's what they say. Okay. Okay. So fear of death is inborn. It must have come from a previous birth. Oh, I have another example. Is security alarm system. It is our fear of loss or death that we put the alarm in. Again, that same fear. Okay. Does it really protect you? I don't know.
So I would think almost a fear of death would be a part of what we are that keeps, so it keeps us alive. Does that make sense?
In a sense, yeah. But it keeps us alive in a state of fear.
It does keep us, right.
Yeah. And that's not good.
That's not good. No, the fear is not.
Fear is always negative. You know, you don't want to be in state of fear at any time, no matter what. Fear is our biggest enemy. Yeah. All kinds of fear. Okay? And this putting a fence, you know, putting an alarm system and all that, it's all because of fear, the deep-seated, deep-rooted fear. You know, I always think that if somebody has malintentions, they don't care about this security system. They'll break everything and then find a way to get in. Yeah. So why bother?
It's not material anyway.
So, You know, when we moved into the house that we have, it was all wired with security system and all that. You know, I said, get out of it. You know, get rid of it. Nothing. I don't want any part of it. So no alarm system. If something has to happen, it'll happen anyway.
It won't happen.
Then
right.
It doesn't matter. Things happen even if you're not, you know, doing anything. You know, you're standing on a roadside, some car comes and hits you, you're done.
Yeah.
No alarm system will help you that time. Okay. So even a vidusha or a learner or a wise person has fear of death. And again, in the Bhagavad Gita, I quoted this. It's a very famous shloka in the Gita, which says that death basically is because of this whole concept of reincarnation, which is so deeply embedded in our culture, in our philosophical system. They say that, you know, death is just a minor change in the whole scheme of things. Because you die now, but then you immediately, you know, or sometime later you'll gain a new life.
That's our immortality.
Hmm?
That is our immortality.
That's our immortality. Okay. But, no, that's not immortality.
That's not immortality.
No. Immortality is that you're not reborn.
So you're out of the cycle.
You're out of the cycle.
Okay.
That's immortality. You've now come out of that cycle. You're not a part of that cycle. But the cycle is that you will die, but your soul, which is attached to your soft, sukshma sharira, or the subtle body, that will find a new physical body and then, you know, embed, go in and sit there, take a new life. And the Gita says that it's like, you know, you're just changing a shirt. You know, the shirt goes old, you change a new shirt. Same thing, you know, same thing with the soul. It has the human body now. When it gets old, the body disappears, but then you find a new body for that soul. That's the Bhagavad Gita. It's a very famous shloka in the Gita. Okay. I think I'm going to stop here. This is a new topic from here on. All right.